You know, you got nice color skin. What color would you say that is?
My color.
The Osage. They have the worst land possible. But they outsmarted everybody.
The land had oil on it.
Black gold. Money flows freely here now.
I do love that money, sir.
This wealth should come to us. Their time is over.
It's just going to be another tragedy.
When this money started coming, we should have known it came with something else. They're like buzzards circling our people. We're still warriors.
I ought to kill these white men who killed my family.
I need you here.
I am right here.
You got to take back control of your home.
I was sent down from Washington, D.C. to see about these murders.
See what about them?
See who's doing it.
Roses, but Moses supposes erroneously. Moses, he knows that his toes aren't roses as Moses supposes his toes is to be.
Well, that can only mean that we're talking about the London Film Festival in this episode. So, hello, welcome to the Movie Robcast. And this is me, your host, Rob Daniel. And as always, I am very happy to say I'm joined by my wonderfully musical co-host, Mr. Rob Wallace.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. We are about to be swamped by children.
Yes, indeed. They are terrifying. We are in... What is the name of the park? It's the park that's by Embankment. Is it Embankment Park?
For lack of contradictory information, yes.
And there is a class of school kids going by. It's a lovely August day. It's about 22 degrees, the sun's out. The only problem is it's October.
We're standing directly outside the building where our colleagues are currently at work.
Oh, actually, they might be able to see us. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so we are talking about the London Film Festival. And this has been recorded on Monday the 9th of October, so it started last Wednesday the 4th. We've seen a bunch of movies right now, so we're just going to give a bit of a digest run through what we thought was good and what we thought was not so good. But the films we're seeing right now, I think that our batting average is pretty high.
Yeah, there hasn't been any single film that's been entirely dreadful.
No, actually, even the films that I thought were underwhelming still were okay. So we started off with Saltburn, which is the new film from Emerald Fennell. She did Promising Young Woman. That was the opening film of the LFF this year. But what's the story?
Oliver Quick, played by Barry Keoghan, is a scholarship student who's just arrived for his first term at Oxford, and he's feeling quite isolated. But then he strikes up an unlikely friendship with... Oh, what's the character's name?
He is called Felix.
Felix, who is the eldest scion of the Catton family, whisks Oliver away to the ancestral manse over the summer holiday, and he finds himself ensconced with, you know, sort of the eccentric, very well-to-do family. And yeah, it's a very black, often outrageous comedy, but it's also like a psychosexual thriller.
Yeah, indeed, definitely. Felix is played by Jacob Elordi, is it?
Yes, Jacob Elordi, who I think most people might know from Euphoria. He's also shortly to appear as Elvis in the Sofia Coppola film Priscilla.
Yeah, so he's in Euphoria. So Rosamund Pike plays Felix's mum. Richard E. Grant plays his dad. Carey Mulligan, who was in Promising Young Woman, she has like a small supporting role. Yeah, I thought it was a good opener. And I think we're going to talk a bit more about it when it comes out properly. So we might do a longer review of it, but it was really funny.
Yeah, this is really sharp, really funny. I'm laughing consistently. There are some memorable scenes in it.
And it really trades on the comedy of awkwardness and embarrassment and there are some things at the beginning when he goes to Oxford and he just isn't fitting in because he's a scholarship student. He obviously is surrounded by
toffs,
supreme wealth and privilege. And there's a real sense of exclusion and social anxiety to that that I thought was very well realised. Then when he goes to Saltburn, this big manor, it becomes, in some ways, it's like a Charles Adams cartoon with this weird family. Other ways, it's a bit like The League of Gentlemen. It's a very good class comedy that I kind of think, is this the only country this could have been made in?
Yeah, I think Britain is, yeah, in terms of that very particular breed of entitled upper class, that lineage, there's a scene in it where it's made very clear in an academic setting that money and charisma will get you further than being a working class grafter.
Absolutely, yeah, that does come across very, very clearly. It doesn't have any real love for the aristocracy and actually presents them as being deeply flawed, quite cruel, often completely ridiculous. There is an element of these things, though, that I think is a bit like a succession. Is this all just part of the ruling class to always show them as being flawed and miserable so that we still allow them to have this amazing life? Because, like, well, at least they're not happy. They're happy. They're living in a fucking castle. They're happy. So I always get a touch of it being slightly disingenuous to present them like that. But it's fun to watch, though.
Yeah, it's like, oh, look how unhappy they are with money.
Yes, with all the money in the world. Barry Keoghan's very good. As you said, there's like a psychosexual element to it that gets quite... Well, it has imagery in there that I don't think anyone was expecting. There's some imagery that's quite shocking. It does work as psychosexual. It kind of works in a horror film sort of way sometimes. It works as a comedy, definitely. It's very funny.
It's also, and I think it's been a preferred adjective at the festival, Highsmithian.
Yes, yes, it is Highsmithian. And Barry Keoghan does have, he is a good leading man. And even though he's a small guy, he is pretty ripped.
Yeah, especially given the character that he's playing is meant to be quite, well, initially seems quite nerdy and unassuming. He turns up at Oxford looking like Harry Potter in his first day at Hogwarts.
Yes, he does, that's right, yeah. But it's not all good, is it, Rob? We had some issues with the film.
Yeah, it gets way too explicative at the end.
It tips its hand a couple of times and it's like, suggestion and insinuation, I think, might have been more satisfying there than just laying it out for all those who weren't quite paying attention. It's like, well, we're all paying attention. You made a really, really compelling film. Why do you feel the need to just so laboriously lay out a lot of things at certain points in the film, particularly the end?
Yeah, it's got some subtle elements to it. It's quite brash in other regards. But yeah, the ending... It doesn't ruin it by any means, but it, yeah, I mean, it does knock a star off.
Yeah, but yeah, because there was one point where I thought this could be a 5-star movie, and it's not. It's a 4-star movie. It's a good movie, but yes. All right, then, well, let's dive into The Killer, which is the new one from David Fincher. And again, I think we'll do a bit of a longer review of this as it gets closer to the release date, which I think is getting released for a week or something at the cinema beginning of November, and then it's going to Netflix for December. Netflix doing that what has I think become a bit of a tradition of theirs right now, which is to leave money on the table from films that will have a good theatrical run. And it worked for Knives Out, right? Knives Out made lots of money in the 1 week that it was allowed to
Glass
play.
Glass Onion, yeah, Glass Onion.
Sorry, yes. Yes, Knives Out 2.
Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so it made lots of money in the time that it was allowed to play. It was yanked from theatres so it could then be put onto Netflix on Boxing Day. And it's like, or Christmas Day, whatever it was. And it's like, I think you've left 200 million on the table there at least. And with The Killer, it's like, this would make money. Anyway, it's an interesting business model to not make the most of your films in every single window and, you know, make some of that money because you're investing so much in production. The Killer, though, quickly give the story to that. So, well, it's one of those films where the characters don't have names, they have titles. So Michael Fassbender plays The Killer. He's billed as The Killer. Other characters in there are called things like The Expert and The Lawyer and that sort of thing. And The Brute, I think, is one of them. And that normally winds me up a tree. Tenet did that, so the John David Washington character was called the protagonist, yeah. Normally it's like, okay, it all seems a bit fucking A-level, that does.
Here was Rob's complete lack of interest.
Yeah, that's right. That's very good. But with David Fincher, it's like, look, I do like David Fincher. I think he's a very, very good director. It's hard for him to deliver an uninteresting movie. And this one is actually, I can see why people wouldn't like this one. The story is very, very rote. So basically, Michael Fassbender plays an assassin. He botches a job. This has ramifications for people around him that he cares about. He then has to go on a mission to, one, try and clean up the mess, because now there are lots of people who just don't want him round as a loose end. And also is on a bit of a revenge mission as well. And he has to basically fight his way through a lot of people to get to the big boss. I mean, as a plot, it's kind of similar to Point Blank, which was the 1967 Lee Marvin film directed by John Borman, which I think is one of the great crime movies. But it's also very, very similar to pretty much every straight-to-landfill cheap film about an assassin who then has to go on a revenge mission because someone close to him was fucked up after he did something wrong. It's like, it's a very, very standard plot, this sort of movie.
It's all about the treatment of the material and the kind of thesis behind it. And essentially, and I think I say this in my review, Fincher is looking at the hitman as a capitalist phenomenon. And Fassbender's character in it is sets out to be, I mean, he relates his kind of ethos via voiceover, but he sets out to be anonymous.
Yeah.
Completely unmemorable. Yeah, a film that says, I'm trying to be anonymous. I'm trying to not romanticize this figure. I'm looking at him as, you know, somebody performing a function.
Yeah.
And it is a thriller. And when a film is essentially getting you to invest, not because it's asking you to care about the character, but it's asking you to be interested in what they're doing, the detail of how they're going to carry out the next phase of the plan, whatever that might be.
And that's the thing, I think that this is certainly the thing that Fincher was most interested in. It is based on a French graphic novel series, which was called The Killer. It does actually have some very, very basic plot overlap with the John Woo film from 1987-8 called The Killer with Chow Yun-Fat, which was very, very romantic, deliriously romantic in its presentation of the noble warrior, of the noble killer.
This is definitely a bromide to that.
It is. It's like, this is one where it's like, this is a job. He could literally be a plumber. It's like, he just turns up and he does his work, and there's a very, very methodical way that he does things so that nothing gets messy. And basically, the film is about how he tries to apply that after it does get messy. So you really see the minutiae of everything that's needed and all the different plates he needs to have spinning in terms of lockups in different states, different aliases, a routine that he has to get into so that there are no surprises, and the way that he then has to kind of like adapt that. His character, I think, is quite similar to the Vincent character from Collateral, which was the Michael Mann film. So I can see why people say, oh, I don't think there's much to that. But I think that your point is right, that this is a capitalist phenomenon. And even though we now live in an age where, for him, it would be better if he wasn't seen, but because there are cameras everywhere, it's very, very hard not to be seen now. Other elements of a completely linked global market make it actually quite easy, or like a lot easier than it's been before, to do this sort of work. That's a blackly comic undercurrent to go through all of this. They must have had great lawyers on this film, because there are so many corporations in this movie, from McDonald's to Amazon to Avis, I think it was at one point. WeWorks, FedEx, and all of them are being used to facilitate him killing people. It's like, oh, well done, because I can remember a time when companies would never do that. And I think there are airlines in there, there are real airlines, whereas, like, you're flying between jobs and stuff.
His flight never gets delayed. You never see him having on a flight that's delayed.
Yeah, so for all its realism, it is still complete fantasy.
Although he does accept a transfer. He does accept to be bumped.
He does, that's right, yes. So yes, but I thought, and Fassbender was really good. So you've also got Tilda Swinton in there. Probably the only other really famous person, if I'm misremembering someone.
Is it David Parnell? Is it?
David Parnell and Arliss Howard, who are character actors who are great, but I think you'd recognise them from something more
than
know who they are.
You'd recognise David Parnell's voice.
What has he been in?
Oh, blimey. Okay, let me look this up. Let me actually...
Okay. Well, while you do that, just one other thing. It's like Michael Mann. So Michael Mann, obviously, in things like Manhunter and Heat, most of it is a thriller, but there will be moments of action that are just absolutely stupendous. This has got a fight scene in it that is
Charles Parnell.
Charles Parnell, yeah, okay. This has got a fight scene in it that is just one of the best fight scenes of the year. It could be the fight scene of the year. It is such a crunchy smackdown, and it goes on for so long. And it's really one of those where you think, both of you were trained to do this, but you were trained to survive something when the odds seem stacked against you. I wouldn't have lasted 5 seconds in that fight. I mean, I would have gone down with that first punch. It would have been like, Rob isn't here anymore. Because you really get a sense that he has had his lights knocked out, at least for a couple of seconds.
Yeah, there's a moment where he kind of has to blink and go, fuck.
Yeah. There's that film Haywire with Gina Carano when he has a fight with her. Actually, very, very similar in terms of just kind of like how scrappy, but obviously how well-trained they are. And there's a scene there when she really, really smacks him one, I think on his nose, and then she smacks him again. And he literally had to shake his face to get his senses back. But it's all very, very quick, but you can see that that has actually dazed him, and he knows he can't be dazed for long. So yeah, it's good. But yeah, so Charles Burnell, what's he been in?
He's literally the definition of a jobbing actor. Like, there's nothing that I can point at that he's been in and be like, I specifically remember him from that. He was in Top Gun Maverick. He was the Rear Admiral in Top Gun Maverick.
Okay.
He was in Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1.
Yes, is he in the room with the...
Yes, he's in the room.
Yeah. Okay, then, well, what are we on to next? Another one we want to talk about.
What did we see the morning of the killer?
We saw the bike riders.
Bike riders, yes. So I guess the bike riders?
Yeah, the bike riders. The bike riders was completely gossamer. I have no interest in it. Rob, what was the bike riders?
It's a kind of grubbly romantic depiction of a Midwest motorcycle club in the 1950s into 60s. Is it 50s? Yeah, 50s into 60s?
No.
So 60s. In the 1960s, directed by Jeff Nichols, starring Jodie Comer, Austin Butler, Tom Hardy, Michael Shannon, Boyd Holbrook. Yeah, essentially it's just a slightly Goodfellas inspired, and lots of freeze frames and needle drops.
So many needle drops. Such a jukebox fucking soundtrack here to just keep the energy going.
It's fun. There's a nice kind of weirdly meta moment where you discover where the inspiration for the biker gang has come from, which also weirdly kind of like ties back into a lot of, I guess, one of Tom Hardy's clear inspirations as an actor.
Yeah, there is a funny moment with that. I mean, we won't spoil it for you because it is actually quite nice to see it, but I've never found the image of the biker interesting. I've never found motorbikes particularly interesting. The image of the biker, just this kind of cool greaser, smoking, and just basically standing there and posturing, is like, I actually find that quite inert. So when you have a film in which it's pretty much all of that...
Based on a photo book. It's based on by something Lyon, but who's played in the film as the guy who's interviewing everybody, who's played by Mike Faist, who's great. And Mike Faist is in, remake of West Side Story.
Right, okay.
He's the best mate in that.
Yeah, he was good. I mean, everyone was good in it. Tom Hardy is always fun to watch when he mumbles through something on his bike. And Austin Butler he looks cool.
God, Austin Butler.
Jodie Comer was a revelation in this for me because I've never actually seen much of her TV work. And I was never a fan of Killing Eve. And I don't think I've seen any film with her in it apart from this one. She was great. I mean, God, her accent work is great. But she really kept the film moving, even though her character didn't really have a character. No one had a character in this. It was thin gruel. And Jeff Nichols, who did Shotgun Stories and Take Shelter and Midnight Express, a Midnight Special, was just content to kind of like it, for it all to be surface, for there to be no investigation of why or what the attraction of this particular lifestyle is, or a complete rejection of society's rules. But then you join a club that has rules that have to be followed
and rules that everybody acknowledges are arbitrary.
That's right. And it's like, and also why, I mean, Austin Butler's just a complete blank. But the Kathy character is just so in love with him. It's like, why? What is the attraction of her? He starts off as quite a square, and then she becomes part of this biker community. And it's like, what is the attraction of any of this? There was no exploration of any of the psychology to this. And I just watched it thinking, if you don't like the image of the biker, and if it bores you, then you're going to get nothing from this film. I mean, I found it watchable, but at the end of the day, it was like, that was thin, that movie.
That was at the start of the day.
Was it the start of the day? Yeah. Yeah, then we had The Killer, and that was much better. Well, should we move on to May, December?
Yes. May, December being the latest film by Todd Haynes.
Yeah, starring Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman. So this is a thorny one. It's a good movie. I actually thought it was an excellent movie. It's currently my film of the festival. And it's a tough one to talk about in some ways because I didn't know what it was about until I started watching it. There were some things, even though it kind of says what it's about pretty quickly, it was quite a surprise. But basically, it's about Julianne Moore plays this woman who is visited by Natalie Portman, who is doing research because Natalie Portman's character is going to play the Julianne Moore character. Julianne Moore plays Gracie and Natalie Portman plays Elizabeth.
And Charles Melton plays Joe.
And you find out pretty quickly that Gracie is married to someone who is much younger than she is, and he's played by Charles Melton. You then find out that a few decades ago in the 90s, there was a scandal around this relationship they were having because maybe the age gap was more significant than the law would allow. And this was a tabloid scandal in the 90s. There were, you don't want to spoil too much about it, but they are now married in the town where it happened. So of course they
Savannah,
still have,
Georgia.
Again.
So Savannah, Georgia.
So they have family still there, and there were children and things like that. It could be quite a messy situation. And the Elizabeth character comes into this and basically tries to get to the truth of Gracie and what kind of motivated her to be in this sort of a relationship. And I thought this was excellent. It's one of those things where it's like, again, it's kind of like a meta commentary, although it's never said. It's not based on any kind of true story. But it shows the pitfalls of trying to do a biopic or a film that's based on a true story in terms of how you have to bend and twist the truth to fit a three-act structure when real life is never that easy.
And essentially you almost have to ultimately pick your truth.
And the decision that you make is going to be how these people are remembered for a long time. Because there's that whole thing right now with The Blind Side. You heard about that?
Yeah. And May, December is a melodrama.
Yeah.
And everything about the way they shot it, you know, it's this wonderful, bright, gauzy cinematography and this very potent score. But it's also very subtle in terms of how it deals with, you know, questions in there around... Yeah, it's not a film that offers easy answers. In fact, it's a film that says there are no easy answers in this.
It just has the characters act, and there is a temptation to try and read motivation into that, which I thought was brilliantly done.
Yeah, so that's my film of the festival. I'd be surprised if all three of the main cast weren't nominated for Oscars.
I put that in my review, but then I was thinking, is this too risky a subject for the Oscars to properly get behind? Because it is basically about statutory rape. And in this particular time when we are reevaluating certain stories and attitudes that we once had around sexualization of children, things like that. And I think this film is absolutely wonderfully done. And even though it doesn't give any easy answers and is actually very non-judgmental, it doesn't mean to say that it doesn't have a moral center to it. It just trusts that you are adult enough to bring your own thoughts and opinions to this, which I actually found quite exhilarating. Yeah, it's proper grown-up cinema.
Yeah, it's... And the fact that it's going on to Sky Cinema.
Yeah, indeed. So it's a Sky Cinema film, and I'm going to see...
Well, in the UK, I think it's Netflix globally.
Right, okay. And it's interesting that, because it's like, well, I mean, it might play okay on Sky Cinema. I do sometimes think with the Sky Originals, they get films like Mona Lisa and the Blood Moon, I think, would be a much better-known film if it hadn't gone on to Sky Cinema, because Sky Cinema is not the place for indie cinema, even though they have lots of indie films. I just don't think that that fits with their brand, and I think these films get overlooked, which is a real shame. This one's got powerhouse casting of Moore and Portman that might get an audience to it. It'll be interesting to see how it fares, but it was an excellent film. So very, very quickly, just after that, so one that I saw that you didn't see was called Eileen. Eileen stars Thomas McKenzie, who was in Last Night in Soho, and Anne Hathaway. Set in the 50s in a small town in Massachusetts. It's literally a one-bar town. Eileen is played by Thomas McKenzie, and she's a clerk in this juvenile detention centre. She doesn't have a particularly happy home life. Her dad was once the chief of police. He's a drunk. He is very, very abusive in his language to her. She is a bit of a fantasist. Eileen has these fantasies that sometimes are sexual, sometimes violent, sometimes kind of both. And she's clearly bright, clearly underused, clearly traumatized in some ways. Into the prison comes Rebecca Anne Hathaway, who plays this new psychiatrist. She's got this Marilyn Monroe hairdo. She's very, very glamorous. She's Harvard educated. She comes from the big city. And Eileen just basically becomes besotted with her. And there is like a definite B-movie film noir feel to this. It's the kind of thing that Fritz Lang or Ida Lupino would have put out in the 50s, although obviously it's some of the content is much stronger than what they would have been able to do. Rebecca, in her part, kind of sees Eileen as the only interesting person around, so they form this friendship. It would spoil it to give any more than that. But this was I thought, a really, really good B-movie throwback that wasn't a pastiche. It was actually a very, very good character study of someone who is traumatized. And there are reasons for that that stem from the society. There's a whole thing about the casual misogyny of 1950s society and how that seeped into the language used by both men and women. And it's also a very, very black comedy. So Shea Whigham plays Eileen's dad. There are some times when he is so cruel in what he says that is actually, I think, intended to be quite comic. It is a very, very blackly comic film. But yeah, it's great. It was a really nice find. And I think that's one of the rare films of the London Film Festival that isn't sponsored by Apple or Netflix or Amazon. So I've got no idea when that's coming out, but it might even come out on a big screen for a while.
It is. It's coming out at the start of December.
Well, there you go then. So at the start of December, see if Eileen is playing at your local cinema, because that's, again, it's going to be one of my films of festival. So Killers of the Flower Moon, what is that one?
Killers of the Flower Moon is the latest by Martin Scorsese, which is about the real historical murders of a number of the Osage Indian tribe back in the 1920s in order to acquire their land rights to oil deposits. Yeah. And the fact that this happened, that the threat came from within the kind of wider community in the form of, believe it or not, white men.
Or really the white community, because it's like the entire infrastructure seems to be in on this campaign of murder to basically kill members of this Native American community.
Yeah, really exploit and kill.
Yeah. Exploit and kill and, yeah, get those precious, precious land rights. And if that means marrying them and having children with them so that you can control the line of inheritance, then so be it. And the characters in this, so we have Leonardo DiCaprio plays Ernest Burkhead, and what's the name of the De Niro character? Is it William Hay?
William King Hale.
Hale, right. Who is someone who has really, he's known as the king, isn't he? Is he known as the king of Osage County or something?
Yes.
Like that? And he's really established himself as the friend of the Osage. He speaks the language. He's supported community projects for them. He's brought certain things into town, like there's a post office and schools and all these kind of things. They trust him implicitly because of the years that he spent with them learning the culture. It turns out that all of this is a smokescreen for a supreme act of cynicism and actually homicidal cynicism. I mean, there's a certain element of serial killing to this, that there's a
The self-justification for it,
yeah,
and almost the fact that they're carrying out these murders or are complicit in them, but it's almost like there's a detachment, the fact that they can do these horrible things to people they know really well and yet treat it so matter-of-factly as though they're not the ones. There's a disassociation.
And I think it comes from implicit racism. There is a real understanding in the white community that the Native American community are subhuman. I mean, one of the characters at one point says, I'm not going to kill anyone. Right. He's an Indian. Well, that's different. Not a mystery. The book that it's based on, you were saying, is treated as a mystery. It's told from the point of view of the investigator, who's played by Jesse Plemons in the film, this guy called Tom White, ironically, who goes down to investigate this spate of deaths that, well, some of them are obviously murders. Some look like suicides, but it's really, really suspicious. But the government only gets involved after the Osage community pay $20,000 for them to take an interest in this. But the film is not a mystery. The film just lays it out from the very beginning, which makes it a very, very bleak movie. There's a dark tone to this one.
Yeah, because your protagonist, or the main audience surrogate, is somebody who very quickly gets wrapped up and gets brought on side into these. And is married to a Native American woman, played by Lily Gladstone.
Yeah, and she plays Molly. Well, she plays Molly, but another thing here is that all of the Native American community have are using their European names. Even though, of course, they're not their birth names, they've all adopted European names as a way to assimilate. And there's a real sense of a culture being subsumed, of being utterly corrupted. And Lily Gladstone's great in the movie. Just the tragedy that surrounds the character makes this 3.5-hour film not the best night out of the cinema, even though I thought it was a great movie.
Yes, it's 3.5. It's never slow. I was never bored. I think because the material, while being weighted, is so well handled, how the story is structured, and there have been reviews calling it a masterpiece. I don't know if I'd go quite that far, but it is incredibly impressive, mature filmmaking from a master.
Yeah, it is. And I would say, because I didn't think that The Irishman dragged. Well, there's a section of this that I thought did drag. And I think the reason it dragged is because there's no mystery to this story. So you are just watching something play out, and it is, and you can see where it's going. I mean, it'll be interesting to watch it again to see if that was to be cut, what would be the impact of it. But there's a section that kind of deals with the marriage between the Molly character and the Ernest character. And I thought that did drag a little bit. But on the whole, it's like that did not feel like 3.5 hours. And as we were walking out, there was this woman who was talking to one of the ushers there, and she said that was a dismal story. But not in a bad way, she said, but it utterly sums up that period or that particular chapter in American history, like recent American history. It was dismal. It's a bleak and depressing film, but it is, I think, a really, really good movie, and it is one that has to be seen. There are moments of black comedy in there. De Niro is great. I think he's actually better in this than he was in The Irishman. He's very... And he's a complex character. He's someone who, again, is using the Bible and religion and Catholicism to justify a lot of this. He's also someone who does act like a king.
And that's the thing, partly because, you know, he can speak Osage Indian, yeah, and the fact that he's such a part of the community and is so well-loved and well-respected that nobody ever suspects he's involved.
Yeah.
Because it's unthinkable.
And it's quite heartbreaking to watch that. The reason why I don't think it's a masterpiece is because the Lily Gladstone character is... And I'd read that actually, even though you've got the big star duo of De Niro and DiCaprio, I think together for the first time in 30 years, I think the last time they acted together was This Boy's Life, that they were both great in, and I really liked that film.
We got to go to the Scorsese Screen Talk, which will be available on YouTube, I think, yeah, by the time you're listening to this, that it was... De Niro who recommended Scorsese work with DiCaprio, because De Niro just worked with DiCaprio on This Boy's Life and had said, hey, there's this kid, he's great, you're going to want to do something with him.
And DiCaprio would have been early 20s in This Boy's Life, and he's a young man in that, but he saw something. And I'd read, though, that the story would, that the Molly character would be the focus of the story. That's just not the case. It isn't. It's much more focused on the Ernest and the William characters. The chapel bells are ringing. The Molly character actually becomes a supporting and almost a tertiary character sometimes, and becomes more of a metaphor for what's happening to her community than a proper character. And the psychology there isn't as explored as much as I liked it to have been, which is what I think keeps it from being 5 stars, and it's certainly not a masterpiece. That said, it is an impressive piece of work, and is a corrective, I think, to how Hollywood have typically portrayed the Native American community, particularly in during the golden age of Hollywood. To go out to Bike Riders, that was a dishonest movie. They were the biking community during the 60s. They didn't say anything racist or homophobic.
There's the Wikipedia entry of the guy who wrote the book, whose name has now gone completely out of my head. Again, the character played by Mike Faist is the interviewer.
It is something Leon.
And he actually made a point of saying that, this isn't the Wikipedia article, there was a point where he got in an argument with somebody who'd unfurled a Nazi flag as a picnic blanket.
So, I mean, if you're not putting that in your film, then you are printing a legend. It's just that the legend is in no way interesting. And actually, it's a much more interesting story to be told. And that's one of the pitfalls of making a film about the past, is that what would have been seen as, like, perfectly acceptable language now seems monstrous. But it's a misrepresentation. And actually, sometimes they were just... Yeah, they would have been homophobic. They would have been racist. I thought Killers of the Flower Moon did try to represent the casual racism of that community.
It also shows it, like, even if it's not being said aloud, like the attitudes that are underlying.
But I think it's one of those things now that it's like you have to use the language as well. You know, the reason that it would continue is because it's always been said and it's becoming normalised. And there were people tutting around us whenever they were saying something that would now be unacceptable. And it's like, well, what are you tutting at? You're tutting at the film, because the film's doing its job. If you're tutting at the film, you just misunderstand it. If you're tutting at the characters, it's like, well, yep, good, okay, fine. But it just seems to be that they were like, they're tutting to be heard to be tutting, and it's like, maybe this one's a bit too grown up for you. Go and see Chicken Run 2, which is actually clashing with Poor Things, which is annoying because I would have gone to see it, but anyway. And it is great to see John Lithgow in a Scorsese film. He was great.
Yeah, I didn't even, I didn't know he was in it, I'd forgotten he was in it. But yeah, I heard his voice and I went, pretty sure that's John Lithgow.
Brendan Fraser's in it. It's a good cast. It'd be interesting to see what Scorsese does next, because his past two films have been real epics of quite dark periods of American history. And to be honest, his film before The Irishman was Silence, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Which was pretty epic as well. And that was, again, like a very deep, adult, heartfelt movie. I don't think he's going to do another Shutter Island. It's interesting because he might now be thinking every single film I make could be my last one. Do I want to do something that's a bit disposable? So maybe he's thinking I only can do really big, weighty projects now.
Yeah, he's tackling kind of, you know, very serious themes. Because, you know, he's 80. Hopefully, like to think many more years, but hopefully some more years to go. But yeah, each film, you know, every film of his could potentially be his last one.
Yeah.
And you know, he spent a long time working on Killers of the Flower Moon, reworking the narrative, trying to get it, you know, everything. They kind of broke the back of it during COVID. I guess his attitude probably like, this is such a time commitment, you know, it's a commitment of time and energy, especially, you know, at a point where, you know, these things are finite. I want to make a film that's going to say something.
So yeah, so anything else before we wrap up?
No, I think that's it from me.
Okay, so let's do plugs. Rob, if people wanted to find you on the internet, where could they do that?
Sure, yeah. If you're looking for me online, you can find my writing at Of All The Film Sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com, at which I'm in the process of writing up my reviews of LFF. You can also find me on Letterboxd at Robert M. Wallace.
Brilliant. And I believe we might even do another podcast that people might want to listen to.
If you're a fan of the 1986 cult classic Highlander, Mr. Daniel and I have done a scene-by-scene podcast on it by the name Another Time MacLeod, which you can listen to wherever you listen to this. You can also, if you're so inclined, drop us a Highlander-themed email at whowantstopodforever@gmail.com.
Excellent, thank you very much. If you want to follow me online, you can do that at electric-shadows.com, which has my writing. You can find me on Instagram. My handle there is at robdan75. You can find me on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/robdan. You can find this podcast on Twitter for the moment at Movie Robcast. But go over to Instagram at The Movie Robcast, because we don't want anyone to support Twitter, and it is going to come down at some point because, yes, Twitter's just a fucking hellscape, even more now than it ever was. If you want to drop us an email, then you can do that at movierobcast@gmail.com. If you liked what you heard and you want to rate and review us, then you can do that wherever you are listening to this podcast, and that would be much appreciated. It always helps us with the rankings and the algorithms and whatnot, and it's always great to get the feedback. So thank you very much for listening. And thank you, Rob.
And thank you.
And we will speak to you again very, very soon.
Expecting a miracle to make all this go away. You know they don't happen anymore.